Hello and welcome to the Veeam Community Podcast. I am your host, Rick Vanover. This is episode 20, Hyper-V, Is It For Me? Here we go. Today our guests are Chris Dearden and Doug Carson. How you doing, Chris?
Hi, Rick. I'm great, thanks. Yourself?
I'm great. Thank you so much for being on. And Douglas Carson is back in the co-host seat. Doug, how are you?
I'm great, thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me again.
Hey, not a problem. I know, Doug, you've been super busy and we weren't able to catch up on a couple of different episodes, so it's definitely great to have you back. So it's kind of funny, guys. I just came up with a title for this podcast literally as I was reading the intro. I'm going to type it in right now to the notes so that I know to put it on the podcast site. Hyper-V, Is It For Me? This week, Microsoft Tech Ed is going on in Atlanta in the U.S., and, you know, I'm watching the Twitter stream for MS Tech Ed. It's actually quite an interesting amount of stuff coming out here, and Hyper-V is a big deal, but there's a lot of big deals with Microsoft, but I'm going to keep my self-promotional Veeam plug limited to the next 20 seconds. We had an announcement released on Monday that Veeam Backup and Replication V6 is going to support Hyper-V for backups. So the question is Hyper-V for me? And I'll be honest with you guys, my Hyper-V experience to this point has really been academic, just to do my blogs. How about you guys? What have you guys ever done with it?
Again, haven't really had a massive chance to play with it, aside from a couple of standalone hosts that might have been put up as a point solution to something. But nothing really on the scale that I've done with VMware.
Right on. And so I guess I should back up a bit. You know, we've all started with VMware virtualization, and that's where most of my expertise and training is. And Doug, I know you're pretty much in the same part, but we all kind of work with Microsoft as well, and that frequently is applications and OSs. But it's one of those things that I guess we need to consider it. And if you've seen some of the futures coming out for the other leading virtualization platform, it's just ridiculous how many features are coming. So by no means is it a fair comparison, but you kind of have to think, well, what makes sense for this application? And when it comes to Hyper-V, just like you said, Chris, I've done the same, played with the Hyper-V role on a standalone host. The one thing I don't understand is the storage and networking. I better put that on my notes to get a Hyper-V storage and a Hyper-V networking expert on here to explain it to me.
Yeah, I mean, I was the same. I mean, I've not had a huge amount of experience with Hyper-V, but I know in my previous role with a partner, we were getting a lot of interest from schools, from small enterprises, all looking at Hyper-V. And at that time, Hyper-V was, 2008 R2 came out, so it had a few more features in it. And it was starting to become more possible, the fact that you could companies were more willing to put it into the environments. Before that, they weren't really, they didn't have key features. But as R2 came along, those features were kind of plugged, and certainly a lot of companies and schools and such like were all very keen on looking at Hyper-V. And there's some cases where, even though we talked about VMware, they were adamant they were going down the Hyper-V route. So it was certainly, from the small to even medium enterprises, there was quite a bit of kind of conversation between themselves and those enterprises about Hyper-V.
And I think that, that's really kind of where it's gravitated thus far. I was at Microsoft Management Summit in Las Vegas in March of this year, and they didn't really have any big announcements or whatever for Hyper-V, but they did have a little bit of information about people that are using it. And during one of the keynotes, they had a really good video about one of the large retailers in the United States, like a store retailer, general merchandise type of retailer, that is using Hyper-V in the actual store. And it's,
oh yeah, they were using it effectively like it was the branch network.
Yeah,
so it was branch in a box type of scenario.
Right,
so if they had what, 500 branches or something like that, and they reduced their server count from 3 boxes down to 1, they're still saving, you know, a lot of tin.
Well, exactly. And I think if I remember right, they went from 6 physical to a cluster of 2. Or maybe it was 7. I can't remember. And you know, really, that's a great application. You know, you've got, and I'm going to presume that all of the operating systems on the guests are Windows, but that's actually a pretty bold assumption for an organization of that size. But as far as what has to actually get pushed down to the store and must run local, you know, you're talking point of sale, inventory, credit card authorization, stuff like that, pharmacy records and stuff like that, you know, those types of systems have to be local in that type of environment, meaning if the WAN's not available, you know, you have to be able to run that type of store. Because I used to support a retail operation, but it was all quote-unquote remote green screen. So we actually just set the failover to run from a wireless broadband card if the primary landline wasn't available, and that was okay for that. I don't think that's going to work for a merchandiser of that size. So, you know, I think with a large number of small deployments, that was a good situation, but you know, I can only count one example where I've seen like a 8-host Hyper-V cluster demoed, okay? And that was a storage partner that I saw at one of the Blogger Day type of events. They had an 8-host Hyper-V cluster with, you know, long-distance migration technologies, all this stuff that was really ahead of their time and stuff they were doing on the other virtualization platform as well. But I'm like, wow, you got to promote this, you know? So I think that the solutions are out there. In fact, one of the things I'm seeing from TechEd in the streams, I saw kind of some of the storage partnerships evolving. I think NetApp had a big announcement of Hyper-V support or something like that. So
yeah, they're doing I think it's like the FlexPod. But instead of being based around VMware, it's based around Hyper-V. So you're still running using UCS, you're still using NetApp, FAS storage, or the vFiler type storage on top of it. And something I discovered doing the Microsoft Jumpstart that they ran a couple of months ago, mm-hmm. a month or so ago, they did a sort of, you know, 3-day webinar, basically. And it became apparent that the networking is... it's not brilliant. It could be a lot neater. And by using something like UCS, that's sort of abstracting the network side of it, you can actually get some quite big wins and make the networking a lot more basic.
Am I right in saying, I remember reading a blog post about the networking, and the networking, you know, with VMware, obviously you team it on the vSwitch or whatever else. But with the networking Hyper-V, you actually use if it was an Intel server, the Intel agent that you would team it from there?
Absolutely correct, yeah. Or if you had an HP box, you're supposed to be using the HP network teaming. So that's relying on an agent installed in Windows. Now, if you have that on a UCS blade or UCS box, you can fail over at the underlying blade level. You know, you can use the alternate fabric. As far as the OS is concerned, it's only seeing a single virtualized network card. Like, I guess someone like Exego could probably do something similar.
Oh, it's Sego. It's Sego. It's not Exego. The X is silent. Come on. Oh, it drives me crazy. Well, Chris, did you attend that Jumpstart then, the webinar?
Yeah, cool. It was pretty good. It was one of those ones that there was the odd little bit of nugget of competitive marketing in there, which I felt spoiled it a tad. Mm-hmm. But the rest, there was some good content in there. The other thing that became apparent is that, you know, for clustering in, you know, back in the Windows days, I remember having to look after an NT cluster that ran Oracle, I think, and being a little bit scared by it. And then 2000 clusters came along, and they were a bit nicer. And then 2003 Windows clusters came on, and they were a little bit nicer still, but fairly similar to 2000. And then 2008 clusters came along, and they were, in theory, better, but still quite scary. And most Windows admins will not have done clustering. And if they will, they'll have only had one cluster. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, it's then trying to go, well, actually, yeah, you're going to deploy an 8-way cluster. And it's enough to make someone reach for the strong coffee.
yeah.
that, particularly if you're then trying to work out your failover order and to stop resources from bouncing between nodes, which I've seen, you know, in a conventional Windows cluster, if you tried to reboot too much at a time, it would basically just get its knickers in a twist and fall over horribly.
Yeah, I think they call that, what's the cluster term for that?
Split brain.
Split brain, exactly. I was thinking role seizure, but that's Active Directory talk. But yeah, so, you know, it's one of those things that I've been wanting to build up my personal lab to have Hyper-V support at home, and I'm going to buy 3 servers. And I'm bummed because, of course, I can't run them as virtual machines with powered on virtual machines like I could do in the VMware world. But I'm going to probably go the, you know, capable PC route instead of a true full-featured server like I did for VMware. Because on my VMware lab, I just went all in with a, you know, something you'd pull out of a typical data center. And, you know, a nice SCSI SAN controller, small end SAN. But nonetheless, it's not a PC. It's not a laptop. But I think when I go the Hyper-V route, I'm just going to have to get, you know, a processor that can do it. But I'm going to go for 3 because everybody does the 2-host cluster, right? But nobody, you know, very rarely do you see demos and configuration examples of the 3-host cluster.
Yeah, because I'd be interested to see how the whole cluster shared volume thing works.
Did they not cover that in the jumpstart?
They did, but again, it was only really a 2-host cluster example.
Oh, okay. Well, just for everybody out there, that was, we actually had Simon Perryman from Microsoft. He was on the podcast on a special episode. If you're interested in those training resources, just Google Microsoft Virtualization for VMware Professionals is the name of the material, and it's on the TechNet Edge site. So according to my Google results, it's the second result, and you can still replay all that stuff.
I was going to say, and if you want to read my review of it, I think I've got a blog post on it.
Oh, that's
my shameless. That's my shameless plug for the show.
We're all about shameless plugs. The show is about the guests, not the host. But that's a good point, Chris. Can you tell us about your blog and then your podcast as well? Go ahead and pimp your cause.
Yeah, I write a blog for all it's worth at jfvi.co.uk. Started it about 18 months ago now.
Cool.
And I probably don't update it as often as I ought to. Perhaps it's because of the different things that I'm dealing with. But yeah, when I was revising, it became a bit of a brain dump for all my study notes. And when I was sort of researching something new, again, it became a bit of a dump for my thoughts. And anyone that sort of gave me a presentation, I sort of interpreted it, put my own spin on it, and put it up there. And people seem to enjoy reading it, so yeah, I'm quite happy to continue blogging. And then at VMworld last year, myself and a couple of other guys from the community got fairly drunk in Copenhagen and thought, hey, let's do a podcast. This sounds like a brilliant idea. There it started, really.
Yeah,
thankfully, we didn't record that first.
Exactly. That's where I was going to go. Good thing nobody had a snowball microphone with them, because I carry mine with me. You never know. I might have cost you microphone first. So, no. That's awesome. Yeah, I've listened to VSoup. I just listened to the example with Chris Wells, or the episode with Chris Wells, and you guys talk about bacon. That's all kinds of good stuff. You're based in the UK, and just tell us a little bit about what you do as much as you're comfortable telling us.
I'm a lead project engineer for a VMware partner and also a Cisco and Microsoft partner. Essentially doing plenty of things with UCS and VMware. Just actually started to look into the unified comms side of things, which I'm finding a bit of a challenge because A, Cisco support regulations are pretty strict, and B, a real-time application is a very different beast to virtualize, you know, from a conventional Exchange or AD server or SQL database, which was the main workloads I was used to dealing with. So I've been having some fun with that.
You know, you bring up mission critical, and I've had this as well in my example, and what I found out almost is that I almost, one time, in one situation, I ended up going one-to-one, one VM, the critical app VM to a host. You know, a pretty bad consolidation ratio. And then somebody told me, well, what's the point of virtualizing it at that point? And I explained the failover is a little bit easier. You know, I would not be one-to-one in a failover or like HA event. I was running HA on that cluster, but I was separating that VM out by itself. But do you, what kind of like kind of up against the wall or corner situations do you find yourself in with those mission critical apps when you're virtualizing them?
Well, it's with the real time ones, because they're voice apps. So you've got things like, for a call center, it's the call recorder. So you've got a constant IO stream. Mm-hmm. So if you try to overcommit, then something not having constant access to its underlying resources tends to upset it. So you find yourself again. You don't quite go one to one host to VM, mm-hmm. but you certainly don't over provision storage, CPU or memory. In fact, you have to kind of Cisco mandate for their voicemail server that you've got to pin it to a CPU. So you know, you're cutting down its flexibility even more.
It sounds very like the environment I'm in, Chris. With we've got quite a large large voice system for call centers and stuff like that, and we've got certain systems that we just can't be in motion. They're pinned, and exactly what you're saying. It's just you've got to treat them with care.
I found that the call recorders, at least in my experience, I worked in a couple of call center environments as well throughout the career, but I found that the call recorders weren't supported as virtual and they were on proprietary hardware, so I was good, right? I didn't have to address that one. Because you're right, they are real time. Maybe I'll talk to you offline about that, get a scoop. But as far as the other components of, especially call center apps, they are complicated. They are tough. They're all talking to each other. They're very time sensitive. I had a couple of what I call jumbo VM databases and large kind of audio recording stores, which were not the live store that hooked right into the phone system. But, that kind of stuff is probably, that's the most challenging stuff I've ever done in my virtualization practice. And I feel for you, especially if you can get the recording capability online, and a lot of people might think, oh, what's it matter? It's a TCP socket, right? Well, yeah, but we're talking, 20,000 lines or some ridiculous number that it could be coming in, and for compliance reasons, you might need every single moment of recorded call.
Yep. Indeed. People talk about the tier one app being Exchange or talking about, say, a SAP or Oracle database. When you've got a call center that, take a example of a call center that I have dealt with in the past, that's processing loan applications, the agents themselves are a tier one resource because they are making the company money directly. If they can't work, then the company can't make money. And this is back before the whole thin client days. You'd have a sort of a pod of six desks, but only five of them would be occupied, and they had their kind of their own sort of desktop cluster. If anyone had a PC problem, they had to switch to the unoccupied desk immediately.
Wow.
Stick a hand up and they'd have desk-side support there to swap out the machine instantly, because they were taking, they were taking loan applications for that particular one.
Human high availability.
HHA.
They demotioned themselves across to another chair.
Yeah. So what they did, they saw the VMware presentation and said, okay, guys, let's just act this out here on the floor. That's awesome. But you know what's funny? Another way to think about that is, loan applications is a good example, but anything that you have to pay to talk to somebody on the phone for, that's money. Every call is $10 to speak to an agent. Or, there's a couple of, service examples. Like I think some of the airlines, if you need to call and do something, you might get a fee or something like that. So, yeah. Or, make a payment over the phone for something, that's money. And it is the new tier one app. I saw a tweet from Ron Oglesby this week. He said, overheard in a conversation or something to the effect that a desktop is a tier one app. And really, yeah, if the people can't do what they need to do, be it virtual or not virtual, it is a tier one app. And then, if it's impacted by those different things, then yeah, that's a big deal. So yeah, I think once we get through the second and third wave of, what we're going with virtualization, we're then going to have to really rethink how we provision it. And, you know, fancier technologies like UCS, which I've not worked on, but I can imagine that that really complicates some of the design, especially in networking and some of the response times that you have to ensure that you get and all that. Yeah, I used to work in real time some material handling automation back in the day. This was before virtualization was really popular. I wouldn't even know how to go about doing that with virtualization, but I'd love to try, you know. So here's a quick question for everybody. So back to kind of our topic of Hyper-V, is it for me? You know, what would be the right situation that you'd ever try Hyper-V? I've got an answer, but I'll start with you, Doug. What would be the right situation that you'd ever try Hyper-V?
I had no problems when I was speaking to clients in the previous role to talk about Hyper-V. I see it as, it's probably good enough for some clients. Kind of small to kind of medium enterprises is probably, I'd have no problem with that. For myself, I was personally putting it into, an environment, then I'd probably start off a bit like the way I did with VMware, mm-hmm. with the test and dev, then onto the low-hanging fruit, mm-hmm. and then, you know, gradually as the features come out and, you know, confidence rises in, then from that. But, that's I'd probably bring it in that way. I think it's certainly, I wouldn't put it into, my personal opinion is I wouldn't put it into a large enterprise, you know, but I would certainly bring it in to a smaller enterprise and again just start off pretty much the way we did with VMware.
How about you, Chris? Could you see a situation where, you know, you'd say, oh, Hyper-V is the way to go for that?
The two that sort of sprung to mind, I don't know if they're sort of the most obvious answers, but I'd like to try Hyper-V certainly as a at the proof of concept level as a VDI host. Hmm. Again, I think you've got the license advantages of you know, the fact that you're not paying for the hypervisor, mm-hmm. And that you can get away with multiple small clusters because of how you got the remote desktop session broker, they call it.
Yeah, you could
set up, and that's quite scalable. And again, you don't have to pay any view licenses either.
Sure.
And again, it could be good enough.
Right.
For a particular type of, you know, VDI in itself is more of a tactical than a strategic decision anyway. And you may well have a second tactical decision of actually, no, we're going to deploy it on what may be perceived as a less than perfect solution by the rest of the industry. But if it does, if it allows you to present that one application that you need to do for your line of business and you're saving yourself a few thousand dollars per host in doing it, then you could well be onto a winner.
And the way I look to that, I'm like, good enough is a common answer. And I like, you know, Doug's test dev is probably something to try. But, you know, my big thing is I don't have the experience with it in production to take it and say, I know this is going to work. I can do that with another platform, but I can't do that with Hyper-V. So that's really just, you know, that's a point in time reference. I mean, there's plenty of people out there who can, and then conversely cannot do it on Hyper-V. But it's just one of those things that, you know, we started with another platform and we went with it that way. But yeah, I think that I got to find the right use case at home. Like I said, I am going to build that lab, get the familiarity there, and whenever I push that first, I guess I'll make a production VM at home, right? Maybe I'll put my domain controller over there. I don't know. You know, that might be that would be a production system at home in my home lab, of course. But, you know, if I'm using a cluster and I'm using shared storage and I'm using, you know, all these features of Windows, that might be good enough to, you know, a side gig or something, come up with an idea. But
the funny thing is, you mentioned about making your home lab maybe trying Hyper-V in the home lab. I mean, I was actually... I was thinking the same. I'm thinking to myself, I've got a couple of boxes here that I've got VMware on, and I've got a bit of shared storage, and I think, right, that's great. But I'm actually thinking now, I wouldn't mind having another couple of PCs with Hyper-V on it, just so I could, you know, broaden my knowledge of it and start to get a bit more involved in it. And then I'm thinking, well, maybe I could have another couple for Zensi.
Yeah, who wouldn't like more gear in their lab? Come on. Yeah, of course not. Of course.
So the first person that can run a V on a VM, then I'll be a happy man, I think.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, hey, let's transition quite a bit in our top discussion here today. Chris is our – this is the first time Chris has been on the podcast. Thanks again, Chris, for being on. I have a gimmick for my podcast. It's called Three Views from You. And what I do is I'm going to ask you three questions, one kind of aimed at the past, one at the present, and one at the future. And I'll start with the one from the past. So, Chris, as a technologist, what's the most interesting story or technical role that you've had thus far in your career? Doesn't have to be related to virtualization or what you're doing now, but something in your past, what's the best story that you can share with us?
Yeah, it is IT related, although it's not virtualization related. And it's really sort of a story of how a chain of events can be really quite serious. And unfortunately, it's a chain of events in which I was the last link. And the result was it took down the entire WAN for a large distribution company. It took down the whole WAN in the UK for about 9 hours. And it started off when I had to test a fax server. We had a server with a modem on it. This is, you can see where this is going. And I was told it was, and this was doing order processing, so it was sending out and receiving faxes all day. And I said, the modem keeps on hanging up. Can you just make sure it'll stay for a good long connected session? So I was scratching my head. I'd not been working in sort of the enterprise side of IT for particularly long, and suddenly had the brainwave, I know, dial it up to the internet for a bit. So found an ISP number, dialed up, left it on for half an hour or so. Thought, that's brilliant. Shut it off again. And then suddenly discovered that I couldn't ping my default gateway anymore. This is a bit interesting. And then I got phone calls from lots of other people that they couldn't ping their default gateways. And they were to the other side of the country. And it turned out that the SQL DBAs had perceived that SQL Slammer was not a threat because we had a firewall. and therefore, you know, nothing was internally was connecting to the internet. Therefore, having those ports available for SQL Slammer wasn't a problem. So they didn't view patching as a priority. And then there was another link in the chain. And then there was me dialing a server up to the internet without a firewall. Not my finest point in IT.
Look out! That's a great story. That's cool. And you know what? Doug, next time we have a guest on that's had the questions, I should share my own epic failures because I've got them too. That's a great story. Thank you for sharing it.
It was amazing. You could unplug the LAN cable from this. Network came up. Plug it back in. Network went back down again. I've never seen so much destruction caused by one box ever.
That is royal. I love it. That's awesome. How about right now? What's going on in your general IT prowess that, you know, you have the most passion for and is pretty cool to you right now?
I think it's just the sudden explosion in the last 12 months of the quote-unquote community. You know, it's always been... So, you know, ever since there's been a way of two geeks to talk to each other, there's been a bit of a community. But it just seems to have got stronger and stronger and stronger recently. And it's transitioned from bulletin boards through IRC, through forums, through blogs, and now Twitter. And it's you know, the next stage is definitely is real life. And it seems to be going from a digital to a real life media. Much faster than you'd sort of perceive it. And the fact that everyone sort of seems to know each other. You know, I go to any other event and I seem to bump into four or five people that actually will bump into me and say, oh, yeah, I read your blog. You do? Brilliant. Hi.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So, I think so discovering that has probably been the biggest surprise for me in the last 12 months or so.
Yeah, the community is royal. It's awesome. I really appreciate it. And my goal is to give to it, right? To the podcast, through blogging and Twitter, that kind of stuff. Here's a good tweet I had last year, or yesterday. Again, I was watching the TechEd tweets. A Twitter member, Mr. Denny, tweeted, he said, I'm going to go sit in, he actually checked in on Foursquare to the, quote, SQL couch. I don't know if that's a formal area, but it's literally a couch in TechEd. And then I said, LOL, have fun, or something like that. And he wrote back and said, well, I actually learned more at the SQL Couch last year than I did in the sessions. So, you know, it's just interacting. It's building your personal network. It's talking to people, and that's good stuff. That's awesome.
It's the whole way track of any conference.
It is.
It's funny that you mentioned, you know, Twitter and all the rest of it. It's kind of funny. I was doing a vCenter upgrade last week, and it was it's a good plug, but Zenworks for some of the monitoring and stuff like that. And we tested the vCenter upgrade, no problem at all. And then we thought, what about Zenworks? Does that support this version of 4.1 update? Well, so literally, I put a tweet out to say, does this support it? And I think Doug Hazelman ended up tweeting me back saying, within half an hour, saying, yeah, no, that's fine, that's okay. But you just wouldn't have had that, you know, just that interaction is just unbelievable. You know, it's just excellent.
Yeah. Doug and I troll the Veeam's Twitter feed. We try to get the most accurate and timely responses, especially when they're coming from, you know, Doug and I both are in Eastern U.S. time, so, you know, that kind of aligns us to a window of opportunity. But, you know, outside of that, we do our best, and it's great that worked out for you. Hey, Chris, into the future, what do you see as the most exciting and most interesting area of technology?
It seems to be the level of automation. Automation's most definitely been a buzzword for a good sort of 12 months. And that the framework to be able to alternate cross-platform and cross-application and linking applications together with things like PowerShell or using VMware's Orchestrator product or Microsoft's, I think, what do they call it now, Scorch or Parlis, as mm-hmm. was, and the various, some of the other sort of enterprise automation tools, that IT seems to be sort of coming together as one, whether it is to form the cloud or not, that's up for another debate. But the fact that technology just seems to be gelling from lots of little clever tools to one big more amorphous being, as it were.
Yeah, for sure, and then that's going to only grow, you know, and you're going to see that. Those lines connected from platform, you know, from OS to hardware to storage to app, you're going to go the whole stack. You know, you're going to really, you know, you might even have single vendor for all of that eventually, which could be kind of scary, but, you know, there's probably no better way to make a seamless integration for that. Yeah, that's a good observation of the future. That's a good one. So we're going to wrap up here real quick. Everyone, Chris is on Twitter, and I recommend that you follow him, at Chris Dearden, and Doug is on Twitter at Douglas_Carson. I'm on Twitter at Rick Vanover, as well as at Veeam. I tweet on behalf of Veeam. If anybody has any questions about the podcast, you can send us an email at podcast@veeam.com. Hey, Chris, I want to thank you so much for being on the show.
You're welcome. Thanks very much for having me.
And Doug, thank you again for being back.
Cheers. Thanks, Rick.
All right, guys. Make it a great night.